Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to a new season of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And I just want to say at the beginning of our new season, how lucky I feel to be able to have these conversations with these amazing artists. And we have a great slate for you this season, so I hope you tune into every episode. And I'm also blown away by how many we have done. This is episode number 69. And who more appropriate than producer, writer, and director Todd Phillips? I first met Todd Phillips when I shot the movie poster for The Hangover, and off the bat I was struck by his relationship with his actors, one of whom was relative newcomer Bradley Cooper. Their bonds were obvious on that set, and magnified in his movies, most of which have been comedies, and which are known and extremely successful for being over-the-top, laugh-packed romps. And though he loves the mayhem, he knows the real draw of any good story isn't found in gags, bathrooms, or explosions. What sucks us in are tales of imperfect people and the decisions they make in any given situation. If you only know of Todd through the Hangover trilogy, or Due Date, or Road Trip, I think you'll be as fascinated as I was to hear stories from his gritty, gonzo start in documentaries. In this episode, we talk about truth and lies in filmmaking, as well as his writing process, which sounds like it might involve a lot of bacon and eggs. Or maybe oatmeal. I don't know. We didn't get into it. But we did get into specifics about his path to success. He says that success has allowed him to make a movie no one was waiting for him to make, and perhaps remake his image along the way. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Todd.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for doing this.
Sure.
I should say at the beginning that we've known each other quite a while now. We worked together on the very first Hangover. I shot the poster.
Yeah.
And you probably didn't know this, but before that I was a big fan of both Road Trip and Old School. And anything sophomoric and male bonding, it draws me in. And, for me to have a hand, however small, in doing the Hangover franchise was really fun.
It always surprised me when I first started out that they would get real photographers to do these movie posters on Road Trip. David LaChapelle shot the movie poster for Road Trip. I couldn't believe it.
Is that true?
Is that crazy? And then you come in to do the Hangover, and it's like, how do they get these guys? And I realize it's a good gig for a photographer.
Oh, yeah, it's a good check.
Yeah, it seems like a great gig, but it's like amazing that big photographers show up for these shoots. It was a big deal.
So yeah, so there's that, and then I just saw your most recent movie, War Dogs, which, you know, really made me actually think differently about our country and about war and about how economy is tied to war, and completely different film for you. So
yeah.
I want to talk about all that stuff.
Okay.
But I want to start with the first film you ever made about a guy who I was very aware of because I was into music and punk rock. I grew up in Fullerton where a lot of punk rock bands started. And so I knew about G.G. Allin, and you decided to make a documentary about him.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, all they have to do is type in G.G. Allin, but I warn them to do it without children in the room.
Yeah.
I mean, he's scatological, violent, suicidal punk rock icon who was completely polarizing.
Yeah, he was the real deal. You know, later when Marilyn Manson came out, I remember people talking about Marilyn Manson as if he was sort of a Gigi thing. But, you know, if you know Marilyn Manson, you know.
It was a marketing act.
A lot of it is a marketing act. Gigi was truly the real deal. I mean, he was also, I think, genuinely bipolar. I mean, you kind of feel bad sometimes because you're watching a crazy person on stage. I hadn't seen him. I went to see him the first time when I was 17 years old. I actually, in the voiceover of that documentary, I say this story. And I remember going to the Lismar Lounge, which was on First Avenue in New York City, and I had just heard about Gigi the same way you had, and you hear these stories, and you're like, is this real? And I'd been into punk rock, but Gigi wasn't even punk rock. He was
own,
like,
it was
punk
like
rockers
art.
Didn't like him. He was just sort of too extreme, you know?
Yeah.
And his music was kind of iffy to a lot of people, although I actually came to love it. But anyway, so I went to see him at the Lismar Lounge, and I remember at the old Lismar Lounge, you would walk in at the top floor and go downstairs to the stage performance, and you walk in on the top floor, and Gigi's at the bar, literally shooting heroin.
At the bar.
At the bar, just sitting there, like, drinking and shooting up at the bar. And you're like, this is like, that's G.G. Allin right there. And I kind of walked downstairs. I was by myself, by the way. I don't know why I went alone. I walked downstairs, and all these kids are downstairs waiting for the show. And G.G. finally walks to the top of the steps, which you can, everybody turns and sort of sees him coming. And he falls down the entire flight of steps and, like, passes out on the bottom. And that was it. There was no show. And these kids are walking by him, throwing beer on him, kicking him, spitting on him. It was, like, the most horrible thing. And this guy's just passed out from, like, what might have been a heroin overdose.
I wanted to jump in and say that the most striking thing about the beginning of the film is that right off the bat, to make your film, you aid and abet a felon.
Yeah.
Because he's in, what, Michigan?
He's in Michigan.
He's been paroled. And you say, come to New York to be in my film, and he has to break his parole to
He was in Michigan serving a sentence for attempted rape on stage. It was a little trumped up, I would say.
Right.
but he did pull a girl up and accost her, and he literally went to jail for it for a year. I had been writing him in jail saying, I want to do this documentary. He's like, when I get out, but you got to come to Michigan. I got to do a year in Michigan of parole. And I'm like, okay, I'll figure it out, blah, blah, blah. He gets out of jail. So we started working out the details. And I go, I just think it would be much more exciting if we did kind of putting the band back together, the Murder Junkies, and going on tour. And he thinks for half a second, goes, all right, you know what? Send me a bus ticket. Send me a one-way bus ticket. I'll come to New York. Fuck it. And so I sent him a Greyhound bus ticket. And he comes to New York, and from that moment on, we were making the movie. He was, a wanted criminal. Not that they were actively searching for him, but he would fuck up so much that eventually they were going to catch up with him because cops will show up and realize he's, wanted in Michigan for violating parole, which is what happens in the movie. In Texas, there's a show. He gets beat up by the audience. The police come. The guy's broke his arm. They arrest everybody. They realize Gigi's wanted in Michigan, and he goes back to serve another year in jail. While we were editing the movie, it actually worked out kind of perfect for the movie. He was in jail while we were prepping. He came out, we shot it, and then he went to jail while we edited it, and then he literally came to the premiere.
Right. How often would you like to have your lead actor in jail while you edit the movie?
It's helpful. Just keep them at bay.
Well, what struck me is, already at that young age, you either stumbled across or very smartly engineered the perfect situation for a documentarian. You found a subject that was going to be unpredictable and dramatic on camera.
Right.
And you picked a subject that there's no way it wasn't going to polarize an audience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
for sure. And I wonder if you did that consciously or if you were just...
Well, I mean, I definitely did it consciously as far as, watching a million documentaries myself, you realize subject matter might be 80% of it, You get a subject like Gigi and the movie's almost made, If you could just get him to concentrate and show up where you need him to show up, it's going to be arresting, to say
arresting.
The least, it was definitely a thing. It's also a little thing that I've always had in me about, you have to make a little bit of noise with something. There's a lot of things out there.
It's interesting because I also look at that. You're a kid. How old were you at that?
I was 20.
20 years
old. I was
old.
At NYU. It started as an NYU project. And what happened at NYU Film School in the documentary program, everybody had to pitch an idea. And then they would only choose seven that got to make the film. And mine was one of the seven that got chosen. But you're only allowed to make a 20-minute documentary. I always knew it was going to be a longer piece. So then once we got it up and going, I ended up dropping out of school because I needed the money from school to finish the movie. It was a whole thing.
So were you pretty sure, even when you were there, of your plan? It didn't sound like you felt like you needed the NYU diploma to go make films.
Yeah, no, I mean, NYU was very much a place where you had access to equipment and to great teachers, by the way, but you didn't need a diploma. A diploma meant nothing
in
film school. What does that really mean?
Well, one of the things that struck me watching it was, I don't know if I could stay with a project like that.
Yeah.
Getting to know him and seeing what he ends up doing in the film. And
I think you forget how hungry you are when you're 20 years old.
Maybe so.
You know what I mean? Now, you wouldn't do it. Now I'd have a hard time sort of putting up with him. But when you're 20 and you're just like, this is it. This is my first movie. This is going to be like this. And we're going to, you just stick
with
it.
But did you want to prove yourself by picking a subject that was incredibly on the fringe?
Yeah. I mean, that was where my taste lied as well. It wasn't so much about, necessarily shining light on a social issue. Those are the kind of movies I love now for sure. But as a kid, as a young man, I really wanted to do something anarchic. Is that a word?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was getting to. I think it was a very smart move, but also a desire to make sure that you were going to make a statement.
Well, I've always been attracted to mayhem. And Gigi was the ultimate of mayhem. And even the movies now, even War Dogs and Hangover movies, and they all have an old school. They have a sense of mayhem underneath.
For sure, yeah.
You're on shaky ground. I've just always had that sort of, I just like that feeling. I like to be surrounded by it. In my own life, personally, I'm not like that. But it's something I've always been attracted to.
Okay, so after you make that film, you make this film called Frat House.
Yes.
And at this point, is narrative even in your mind, or are you just a
documentary? Well, no, it is. I mean, I always wanted, you know, people ask me that about documentaries and then making the jump to feature films. And as a kid, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I got in through documentary because, weirdly, I got into NYU through documentary photography. There's like three ways you can get into NYU back in the day. I don't know what they do now. You write a script, you shoot a movie, or you do like 10 photos, like an essay. And I had done this photo essay, a documentary sort of photo essay. And I had just sort of fallen into this idea that truth is stranger than fiction. It always sort of turned me on so it wasn't so much that I just wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. I think documentaries have a beginning, middle, and an end, just like a regular narrative film.
Sure.
If you do it right, I think there's directing involved in documentaries. People think it's just point a camera and go. It's really not. If you've made documentaries,
sure.
You made a great music documentary, and you know it's a little bit about getting the movie you want. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, look, if you don't have a focus, you're going to make a really unfocused film.
Yeah.
You have to have a point of view.
It's really interesting. I was just reminding me of a story. I had made a documentary about the band Phish. Have you ever photographed them?
I have never.
Okay.
No.
So Trey is he's the lead guitarist.
Yeah.
The
no,
one
I know
of the
all
great
about
guys in like rock and roll. And I remember doing an interview with Trey at his house and doing all these things, and we leave, and we spent 8 hours at his house in Vermont, and we leave, and I'm going back to the hotel, and I go, oh my God, I left my notebook at his house. And he calls me at the hotel, and he goes, hey, you know, you left your notebook here. I go, I know, and I'm thinking, I hope he didn't read it. And he goes, you know, I flipped through it just because I was interested, like, what's in this thing? And everything we had done that day was in the notebook. Have him go through his record collection, let's read an old review, let's da-da-da-da-da. And he felt so manipulated in
right.
a way. And I'm trying to explain to him, well, that's what directing a documentary is a little bit. And he goes, but it all felt so organic and so,
like, hey,
it just
happened. Those records?
Yeah. And he goes, and it just made him really, like, doubt the whole thing
right.
in a way that was really, really funny.
Well, I read something where you said that that lying is an essential skill in making documentaries. And, you know, it's funny. I remember when I was a photojournalist in school, there was a kid up in a tree. There was a rally at our college. There was a kid up a tree with a sign. And I think I told him, hey, go further out and hang your sign over. It'd be a better picture, because where he was, the tree was behind him and
sure.
you couldn't really see him. But if
yeah.
he leaned out. And so I told him to do it, and he did it. And picture, and the next day it's on the front page of the college newspaper, right?
right?
And then a couple other photographers from the school went to the journalism
God.
Instructor and
right.
said, oh, he set that photo up,
right.
you know, and this whole thing. And I remember even back then thinking, those guys have it completely wrong.
Yes, like, I agree with you.
To give that message of that photo the way I saw it the best, I had to move him.
That's right.
Because if you had him against the tree, you couldn't see him.
Right.
So when I read that thing about lying, mm-hmm. and you can explain that to me better what you meant, but I read it as sort of the same kind of hustle you have to do to get a script made, or the same kind of hustle to, like, get a product into an investor's
right.
office for a
yeah, maybe
for a
manipulation
pitch.
Is a better word. You know,
right.
there's a certain amount of manipulation involved in directing. But I do remember on the first day of walking into this documentary class at NYU, taught by this woman, Christine Choi, no joke. She said, first rule of documentary films. She goes, lie. Lie to everyone. She goes, lie to me. I'm going to lie to you. She goes, and if somebody comes to me and says, why did you tell your students to lie? She goes, I'll lie and say I didn't. And it's just very much about what you said, getting the photo, getting the thing that, you know, you're not changing the message. You're just getting it done in a much more
right.
concise and sort of photographic, or in our case, you know, economic way.
Well, and there's nothing that's completely objective. The minute you hold a camera up to your eye and decide to point it in a certain direction, you're having a point of view.
Yeah, it's funny because people talk a lot in documentaries about fly-on-the-wall filmmaking, you know, and I really do believe in the 50s and 60s when Albert Maysles was making Salesman,
mm-hmm.
there was a value and there was a real authenticity of fly-on-the-wall filmmaking, because I think in the 50s and 60s, people didn't realize the power of the camera.
Yes.
And I think everything changed once, you know, I don't know what the moment is, but definitely by the time we were making Frat House, people understood that this camera could change your life. So not only are you manipulating it, but they're manipulating their performances in some way. And the key to making a good documentary is to getting past that. The same way a director might tell an actor, stop acting, you know, it's, you want your documentary subject to stop putting it on. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah.
And that is the hardest thing you find, of like getting past that. But I didn't have that with Gigi Allen, because half the time he was whacked out on alcohol or drugs, so he didn't, you know.
Right.
But you do get that a lot with documentary subjects. So
more and more as technology.
And I think just more and more in reality TV and technology, and people just realize what that is. I think it's harder now to make a great documentary than ever, and they're being done all the time, but it is amazing.
Well, we should quickly say, Frat House never came out.
Right.
And HBO bought it, and it was basically you and your partner, Andrew Gerland.
Yeah.
And you guys went to make a film to sort of explore what makes adolescent men want so bad to belong to a gang or a crowd or be accepted.
Yeah.
And you got kind of halfway with one house, and then they turned on you.
Yeah, which is like part of the movie.
Right.
I mean, the movie became the journey, not the destination.
The journey about the film.
The movie became very Nick Broomfield in the way of like, oh, this is going to become a movie. We never had that intention. This is going to become a movie about making, about trying to make a movie about hazing and fraternities and that.
Well, what I found it, you know, as a father of girls especially, I found it so disturbing.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm holding on to the DVD because I'm going to show my daughters the DVD before they go off to college.
Yeah.
Because the second half of the film, you have to switch gears because you get sort of kicked out literally
of one
with
school.
The threat of violence of this one school. So you have to go find another school. And you end up, the deal is you have to pledge.
They're going to take a little bit of like legal... I don't really know what the reasoning was, honest to God, of okay, we'll do this and we'll partake in this, but if you guys go through it, I felt like it took a little bit of heat off of them in a way. And we kind of liked it for the movie anyway.
Right, because you're in the film. You become...
Yes, we had become like, characters in the film up to that point anyway.
That's right. But now we see you going through Hell Week and being pledged and being degraded to the point. At one point, you're in a cage with... spit and vomit and food being put on you.
That was the lowest point of my life.
I bet it was. But you know,
it wasn't really, because at the same time I'm thinking, oh, finally we're getting that thing that we came for, you know, that.
But your partner ends up pulling out. He's got stomach pains. He goes to the hospital.
Yeah.
And I'm watching you in that cage and I'm going, he got an ulcer from it.
Yeah.
Well, it was very
stressful. It was a very
stressful
time in our life.
But I'm watching you thinking, well, here's a guy that commits to a project and doesn't quit. I mean, were you always that guy?
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's a little bit like by any means necessary attitude of like, I'm just going to get this done.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna, you know. And you know, movies and photography, like that image of that kid in the tree, these things live on way past this pain and this horrible moment is going to live on. So you're capturing something, like you said, you're going to show it to your kids one day, and that's a great thing. So you just kind of, you know, buck up and just go through it and... it was fun. It was wild.
When you actually, because you made it through.
Yes.
So you, I guess, became a member of the
fraternity.
Oh,
yeah. They're still my best friends.
You're kidding.
Yes.
No.
I'm kidding.
But did you, you know, because I guess, if I understand correctly, HBO had to go out and sort of try to validate these releases that you'd gotten and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, how did that happen that it ended up not coming out?
We made a couple mistakes on that movie that were totally our fault. We'd go up to these kids in the day and we'd go, hey man, you know, we're going to shoot tonight at da-da-da, and you remember? And they're like, yeah, cool. Listen, I just need a release signed by you. And the kid would look at the release and go, oh great, you know what? My dad's a lawyer. I'm just going to fax it to him. This is how long ago it was. Fax it to my dad. Is that cool if I give it to you tonight? And then I'd go, oh yeah, for sure. And then I'd go, oh, you know what? I actually gave you the wrong one. Let me give you the right one tomorrow. And then, like, we do it at night when they're drunk and whatever, and you go, oh, hey, I got that release, and all of a sudden they're signing it. Because we didn't want to deal with the parents telling them, do not, by any fucking stretch of the imagination, think you're participating with a documentary.
Yeah.
So that is not really an ethical way of making a movie. And we definitely were guilty of that.
But I'm sure you also felt when all of these kids that had signed releases, all of a sudden their parents were like saying the releases weren't valid. I mean, there had to be a little bit of sour grapes on your part that...
Oh, yeah, I mean, for sure. And I was a little bummed out that HBO kind of pulled the plug on it, because I really felt like... I think HBO, to this day, does the greatest work in documentary, and I think no one's done more for documentary films than Sheila Nevins. It was a little disappointing in that we were making a movie about a bunch of rich white kids whose parents are very influential and have fax machines, and all of a sudden it's like, oh no, let's not even go down that road. But that was a long time ago, and quite frankly, like you just said, you have a DVD of it. The movie has gotten out there. It's on YouTube, you know, it's like people It's everywhere. So
right,
in a weird way, it kind of has this cult status because it was never actually officially released. I mean, it won the grand jury prize at Sundance Film Festival.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating documentary. And not only that, but like in the light of what happened at Stanford recently and the ability for the parents of the Stanford kid to get him off.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that the schools still sanction.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. I mean, what did you take away from that experience? Like, you say you went in there trying to understand why men try
to belong. Well, it's really true. I mean, for me, I grew up with a single mom and two older sisters. And people think because of the movies I've made, Hangover and Old School, that I have this very, like, bro mentality. You know, the movies are about guys who party and da-da-da. And really, they're about guys who make bad decisions. And really, my sort of obsession with male culture came from growing up with a single mom and two older sisters and not really having a man in my life. I've always been fascinated by sort of guys' relationships between just like straight guys, friends, like hang out and what they do. And my mom always taught us as kids, you do whatever you can do to stand apart, to be an individual. And I was amazed that these kids would get to school and the first thing they would do is look for something to belong to, look to get rid of their identity and instead be identified by three letters of a fraternity name.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That just never really reconciled with me. So that really is Frat House came from, a little bit of like, what is it that this men in particular have this need to belong to a group? That is just not the way I was raised. And Frat House to me is while it's probably dated right now, is a really good time capsule of a time of just, you know, I like to think things have changed a little bit in that culture. I don't really pay
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know if it is a time capsule.
Yeah. I mean, there were things in Frat House we weren't allowed to film that kind of found their way into Old School and other things I've done that are just like,
right,
you know, where the kids would be like, you're not filming tonight, you're not filming tonight. It's just like wild.
It's amazing because the things they let you film, you would think they would be saying, you're not filming tonight.
Oh, no, the other stuff was much worse.
God, it just blows me away.
But it's funny, you talk about directing, and this might be too inside baseball, but the very first, you probably don't remember, but you go back and look at the very opening shot of Frat House and the camera. We're shooting 16mm film, by the way. The camera's under a street light, and maybe 300 yards up is this bar on a corner, right? So I go to this kid, Beanie, who is a fraternity member, like the toughest guy there, who, by the way, we named Vince Vaughn after in Old School Beanie. But so I go to Beanie and I say, Beanie, I put a little lavalier mic on him, and I said, Beanie, I want you to go in that bar. I want you to find a kid who's on the fence, and I want you to take him for a walk, and you're going to walk from that bar to this street light. And by the time you get to this street light, I want you to convince him that he's got to join, I think his fraternity was called Sammy. And he goes, yeah, I could do that. I could do that. So now, is that, and again, that came back at us too when HBO wasn't going to air the movie, saying, well, you're setting these kids up. And you go, well, I'm setting up a moment. He's going to do that anyway inside. Well, the bar's not letting us film inside. And the lighting's not right. We're under the street light. What is that? Is that, you know, like at what level are you fucking with it too much?
Yes.
For us, that's what directing was, but it could be wrong.
No, I agree with that 100%. So let me ask you this. When you were growing up with two sisters and a mom, you said in some article that your mom would say you were born bad. You were caught shoplifting and such.
Right.
Was that a thing where, from your mom saying that, did you see yourself that way? Did you?
I think she was more celebrating that fact in a way of like, I think you were just born bad. Because my thing was, again, I really wasn't a bad kid, but I like to hang around with bad. Again, I like to be around the mayhem.
Right.
So I was very just attracted to mayhem even from a young age. But when you're 12 and 14, what's really mayhem in suburban Long Island? So you're hanging out with kids that are trespassing and shoplifting and, you know, vandalizing things. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. But yeah, that's the crew that you kind of run with just to be around it. So,
right.
Yeah, I do think, my mom did say that, but I don't know that was so much of an odd admonition as it was.
So you didn't see yourself as like, I'm a bad kid.
No.
Because you end up at NYU, I mean, that's...
But NYU, you go back, you know, about documentary photography.
Right.
The way I got into NYU, it was 10 or 15 photographs of this crew of like, you know, white boy bad behavior on suburban Long Island doing dumb shit, lighting fires and that sort of boredom in the suburbs and what teenage boys who are 15 before the internet would do.
Are there traits you look back among your group of friends and go, oh yeah, it makes total sense, I became a director?
I was definitely the instigator for sure.
You were?
Yeah, I was the idea guy and then I would just step back and photograph it.
And were you a good leader of your friends? Were they?
Yeah, I had a good little crew.
Yeah. And so when do you get the sense that like, oh, I, like you get into NYU on your photography, but at that point, did you dare to dream that, that movies would be that next step, or did you think you wanted to make movies, or was it all about photography at that
point? No, I got in through photography, but into the film program, because I always just, that was my thing, I just really wanted to make movies.
Do you remember what age you were when you realized that, oh, you can make movies?
Yeah, I know. I don't know what it was for you when you suddenly realize all those names you see before the movie starts. It's like, oh, you mean when you're a kid, you think probably the actors make up the lines, right?
Right, exactly.
But I think I was probably around 12 or 13 where I started really paying attention to, like, filmmaking as a thing. I don't remember if it was a particular film, but I just definitely around 12 or 13 became aware of it. But like most everybody else, I didn't have an uncle in the business. I was as far from Hollywood as everybody else. And you're
did
like,
you have a video camera?
I didn't have a video camera as a kid. We didn't even have cable. I mean, like, we, you know, I was just something I just wanted to do.
So you needed NYU. You needed the
I did. No, I love NYU. Listen, I love it. And while I didn't graduate from NYU, I should say I have a degree from NYU because after The Hangover came, I had been doing interviews to support these movies for, you know, at that point, probably 10 or 12 years. And it would always come up, oh, you went to NYU, oh, but you didn't graduate, why didn't you graduate, da 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 da. So I think after the, oh, no, it was after Hangover won the Golden Globe for best comedy or musical, yeah. I got in the mail a letter from the dean of NYU, and it was a diploma, and she wrote, Todd, now you can stop saying you didn't graduate from NYU. And so he sent me a diploma, which was nice.
So after Frat House and Hated and the Fish movie, were you like consciously like, I'm not going to make another doc, I'm going to make a narrative film?
Yeah, what happened was I met Ivan Reitman at Sundance when we were there for Frat House.
Okay.
And Ivan Reitman was there with his son, Jason Reitman. And Jason had come to a Q&A for Frat House and asked a question. I didn't know who he was. He said, where did this movie come from? Why did you do it? And we kind of jokingly had said, well, we were making a trilogy of movies based on 80s comedies, you know, and the first being Animal House, and next we're going to do Stripes. It wasn't so much a joke. We actually pitched HBO that Andrew and I would go to boot camp and do a Stripes movie. Then walking down the street, and Jason Reitman walks up to me with Ivan Reitman, who I didn't know facially, you know, and he goes, oh, Dad, this is the guy I was telling you about. He's one of the guys who made the film that I was telling you about, Frat House. And he's like, oh, Ivan Reitman, nice to meet you. I said, oh, hey. And he goes, I really want to see that movie. Can you get me that movie? So I sent a print of it to him in L.A., and then he called me up and he asked me to go to lunch. I live in New York, and I flew there to meet with Ivan.
Amazing.
And he started talking to me about doing features, and he's like, can you write? And we write on our documentaries, and I'm like, yeah, I could write. Always say yes to whatever anybody asks you in the beginning. And he goes, I've always felt, if you watch Animal House, you know I loved Animal House, that the road trip part of Animal House, where they go on that road trip, could be its own movie. So he actually had the idea. He goes, would you be interested in doing a road trip movie? And I said, yeah, I could figure something out in that world. That makes sense. I see what you mean. That is a great part of the movie. Not my favorite part of Animal House, but okay. And I didn't say that. And so then we went off with the directive of, can you write a movie, a road trip movie?
So you didn't have a pile of scripts?
No, nothing.
The first thing you wrote was
yeah,
road trip?
Ever.
So
yeah.
What did you do? Did you just sit in a room and sort of bounce the dialogue back and forth? I mean,
yeah.
Did you develop a process that you still use now?
Yeah, for sure. Which is like you just go get breakfast every day and just talk for 3 or 4 hours. And then we both go back and we write a little. And then we send the pages to each other that night. We read each other's pages. We meet the next day for breakfast. Same thing. Da, 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 you know.
And do you read it out a lot, like to hear the dialogue
yeah.
work?
Yeah, we do. I mean, I've worked with different writers over the years. That first writer who I wrote first three movies with, Scott Armstrong, that was our process. And then I have different processes with different writers.
Kind of amazing when you think back to one meeting or one thing that turns things
yeah.
for you.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true. Timing is...
Yeah, it's kind of incredible because you figure if you don't meet Ivan Reitman at that thing, maybe the buzz of that documentary
goes away.
Gets you to make another documentary.
Oh, yeah,
you
know, yeah, for sure.
And you keep doing that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's true.
Well, I met you, like I said, on The Hangover, and I remember distinctly on that first movie, your relationship with Bradley Cooper at the time. Mm. And I felt like you were in his ear and in his head. You know, like I watched you guys and I thought there's this sense of you were telling Bradley Cooper everything he's going to be before he knew he was going to be it.
Oh,
I don't know
right.
if you remember that, but
I don't. Actually.
But it was such a sense of you instilling him with the confidence he needed to be the star he became or something.
Well, it's funny you say that because I remember after we did The Hangover, before it came out, I wrote a letter to each of the guys, Zach, Ed, and Bradley. And in Bradley's letter, I basically said that which was the only thing holding you back at this moment is confidence, and you have to just have it and go because you have such raw talent. I don't remember how I worded it, but I do know that Bradley's brought that letter up to me as recently as a year ago, as he still has it and how much it meant to him in a way of like, that really sort of made him feel like, okay, I could do this. I'm not taking credit in any way for Bradley's career, but meaning there was this, we had this great connection from very early on. I mean, he's now my best friend, but we had this really intense connection really early. I love him.
Well, I definitely noticed it on that day because I think it was specifically related to kind of owning his presence mm-hmm. in front of the camera, because mm-hmm. that character in The Hangover
yes.
has to totally own himself.
Right.
He does in the film, and I think you wanted to make sure he did on the poster.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably.
And I wondered if that confidence for you is something that you early on had to give the same talk to yourself as you gave that letter to Bradley.
Yeah, probably.
Like, in other words, yeah. were you faking it until you actually had it?
I think so, to some degree, for sure, yeah. I think probably for the first long time. I might still be faking it, I don't know.
No, but,
no,
I think,
but it's true.
I think that when you walk on set and you've got six actors looking at you and maybe you haven't worked with all of them before, you know, in life they say that first impressions are so huge, but I think on a set especially, setting the tone on a film, like, is that something you sort of learned? Like, how do you set a tone on the film so that people will go where you want to go? And
yes, it's something, it's really one of the key things about directing, and this is not my quote, I've read this, but it's the truest quote. Like, it's really important to set the tone of the movie on the set of the movie, I think. It's really important to feel that, because that sense finds its way into the film. So what's the tone of my movies? Well, it's mayhem. You come to our set, and it does feel a little bit like the inmates are running the asylum. And it's not that we don't know what we're doing. We really do. But we like this kind of loose vibe of like, you know what? What if we do it over there? Let's just fuck it. I know we set up to shoot it here, and I know you brought in this thing, and we, you know, production designed over here, but let's just fucking shoot it over there. And it's like this sense. I remember Robert Downey telling me on Due Date, he's like, I've never been on a movie. Like, I feel like I'm on a student film. He's like, A, the studio has never showed up one time. He's like, B, there's like, it's like eight people making this movie. And yeah, we have a big crew, but when you come on, it's a really intimate set, weirdly. I find that you want to make it that the actors are really comfortable, you know, to be vulnerable, because there's nothing harder than acting, and especially in comedies. So often you're trying something that doesn't work, but you want them to feel free to try that and
yeah.
then not go, what the fuck was that? You just go, all right, let's do another one where blah, blah, blah. So it's a really intimate set. And when Robert said that, I like sort of stepped back, and it's like, it's true. I got Robert Downey here, Zach's here. It's not a small budget movie. It's Warner Brothers, but there's just eight people around, and everybody else is outside or, you know, or around. All the support's there. I'm not saying they don't work on the movie, but there's just this really sort of renegade and loosey-goosey thing we try to keep with the movies.
You know, he told a story about how on Due Date, he would come in every day and have no regard for what was on the script.
Yeah,
and he would want to, like, just throw it out and try something new. And he said at the end of the movie, you said to him, I figured it out, you just hate paper.
He does. Because he would come in, I'd walk into his trailer, he'd rip up the sides and go, what are we really shooting today? And then we would sit down and write, me and him and Zach would come in, and Zach hated coming in because Zach hates confrontation. And me and Robert would just fight like two brothers and sometimes drag Zach into the middle of it. And poor little Zach, who's the most peaceful, you know, easy to get along with guy in the world, is just like, doesn't want this. And he thought he was just going to shoot the pen. And we end up just rewriting it on a napkin or even a piece of paper. I think he hated the typed word. I think he just wanted it. So oftentimes we would basically just rewrite the scene
right.
with pen, and then we'd go shoot that.
So it's one last final rewrite.
It's a final rewrite. But Robert, I mean, to this day, is the most additive actor you could ever work with.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he is like nobody else. So that remains one of my favorite movies because of the experience of making that movie. And we also shot that movie. It took place across the country, and I had this idea, we're going to shoot it like Coppola shot Rain People. We're just going to drive in a car, and we really did. We moved a lot, and that's what I meant. Like, it felt like this independent film. Like, we were just out there in the middle of the country. Nobody knew where we were. We weren't reporting back. It was like, we'd never hear a word one from anyone. It was really interesting. And we had that freedom a lot because The Hangover did so well, and it was my next movie, and, you know, I've learned that goodwill in the movie business is perishable. When you have it,
you have to use it. No, but I think that there's also a little window on the complexity of your job, though, in that story, because, yeah, you want to catch lightning in a bottle, and you work with these improvisers and people who can do that. But at the same time, if it goes off the rails too, like you have to keep the whole movie in your head when someone says, what if we did this?
Yeah.
And you have to know, like, that's not the tone, because one of the greatest quotes I ever heard about making films is for an actor, they have to know what movie they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give too much freedom, then you won't have a consistent tone throughout the film. So did it take you a while to really be able to live in that world of letting chaos happen, but still knowing how to keep it on track?
Yeah, it didn't. I think I took to that pretty quick because, believe it or not, we don't do a ton of improvising in our movies. We do sit in a trailer and rewrite in the morning, but then we know what we're going to go shoot. And it's not that, you know, I'd be an idiot if I had Zach Galifianakis there and said, no, don't change that line in the moment. He could do whatever he wants. But it's not a ton of improv because we really shoot the movies. We try to shoot the movies like movies. You know, you hear stories about comedies and it's like, oh, we set up three cameras, we shoot, and the actors go crazy. We don't do that as much, and we do it less and less as it go on, because I enjoy the filmmaking part of it so much and trying to make it look and feel like a movie and have scope and be lit correctly for this direction and not have to worry about a camera in that direction.
Right, you know? Right.
So it's not as much improv, but it is certainly the actors get their stamp on it before we start shooting. You know, we just sit in a room and go, all right, let's put it on its feet, let's change that, let's change this. And then we basically shoot the day.
And have you gotten to the point now where you can see the movie enough in your head?
Well, it's funny. I find it so different because I also, I've written on every movie I've done. And I often think, I get scripts sent to me and go, you want to direct this? And I don't think, like, I find it more impressive directors who don't write, because they just take this thing and they're able to do it. If you're writing on something, writing takes forever. You know, it's 6 months minimum, more likely a year and a half. And it's so in your blood by the time you go to shoot it that it's been in your head for so long. So yeah, it is there. But I don't know if somebody just handed me, you know, here's the new Star Wars, go make that movie.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't know how to do that because it's not in me.
It's not your intention of putting into it.
Yeah.
Well, The Hangover and that series was such a giant success. I mean, at the time, I think The Hangover was the highest grossing R-rated film ever.
Right.
And
comedy, I think. Passion of the Christ had us beat.
Oh, yeah. But I think that when that happens to you, everything else goes out the window. You're going to do sequels. You're going to ride that train. You have to. Like, do you ever think about the obligation that comes along with success that you have to sort of follow it and see it through?
To some extent, and a lot of people have a very mercenary attitude about, like, oh, you did three movies of The Hangover, you just want to make money and da-da-da. And what people find hard to believe is that the four of us, five, six of us, we couldn't believe we got to do another one. And we couldn't believe we could do another one. We had such a good time making those movies that we were like, why wouldn't we just do this? Like, people want to see it. Let's just go and go for it. And we kept trying to push ourselves, and people will say we didn't, or critics would disagree. But we kept trying to push ourselves and make something even a little more fucked up or twisted than the last time.
Right.
So that was sort of the joy in it. So it wasn't as mercenary as it seems, I think, on paper. And I think a lot of times with movies, it's like that, you know. Now, of course, the studio doesn't give a shit that you guys are friends. They want another movie because they want another movie.
Sure.
But no, I mean, for us, it was very much about, like, oh, we get to go to Bangkok and just hang out for 4 months and just make a fucking movie. Let's go. But it helped that I was making with these guys, and it was just, you know, the same crew, the same everything back together. It was really the best time of my life.
Did you guys ever sit down and sort of talk about how this same phenomenon had happened to all of you? Like,
oh, that's funny.
The power that you now had to go make projects. I mean, all these actors were able to go off and
do their own thing.
Do things. And yeah, did you?
No, we never actually had that conversation. That's funny. But I do remember being in London with all the actors on the press tour for the first Hangover, and we were getting numbers, I think, for the opening weekend in the US. If I have it wrong, maybe it was a week later. And I do remember us all having a drink together, but not having the conversation of, like, our lives are going to change, but more just like, wow, this is going to be some ride.
Well, when you think about it, Ed Helms was really only known for The Office at that point.
Right.
And Zach was sort of known as a stand-up.
Right.
And Bradley, the biggest thing he'd done is Wedding Crashers, right?
Yeah. He had done some television that was pretty great, too. He'd done that show Kitchen Confidential. Not that it was a huge show, but he had shown
right.
he had.
But
know.
it's pretty amazing, because you look at those guys, and they've all gone to have these massive careers. Did you look at a bunch of actors for Hangover? Did you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the studio really had an idea that we needed one quote-unquote star in it. And I really was hung up on sort of just finding the right guys. And so that became a whole thing of, well, if you're going to do it with these guys, you have to make it for that much. If you get this guy, you can make it for what the budget really was. You know what I mean?
See, I think that says something right there, that you didn't go, okay, I'm going to get more money. And
right.
Because it seems like there's a lot of confidence in play at that. Like, well, the studio's saying
right.
they'll bet more on me if I take someone that's more of a known thing.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I had done a movie right before The Hangover, not like 2 years before, called School for Scoundrels.
Yes.
And that movie was a disaster, meaning financial disaster. I mean, it didn't make money. It was like one of these ones where you go, oh, fuck that. But I remember the problem with that for me was the studio at that time was the Weinstein Company saying to me, hey, by the way, we want you to make this PG-13. And I'm like, you know, a month away from shooting and had to reconceive it. And what I should have done is go, nah, I'm kind of an R-rated guy. That's my thing. I don't know how to do that. It's got to be this. But I didn't feel like I had the confidence or power or whatever it may be. And I'm just happy I'm getting a movie made. So I think I learned from that experience, which was really important. You learn from the lows as much as you could from the highs. I think I learned from that, which is like, you know what, just stick with your instinct. Your instinct is the only thing that makes you unique and different, and you know, your instinct is all you have. So I think that fueled my sort of confidence, like you say, on The Hangover, which is just like, no, I'm just gonna do it this way, I don't care, so it's less money, we'll figure it out, you know?
Right. It's so funny because you look at all three of those guys now and they're all big stars, and they're the ones in the conversations where if you get Bradley Cooper, we'll give you this much money.
Right.
Now I mean, someone's gotta make guys. A star, you can't just go get the ones.
I agree, it's true. But everyone's, not filmmaker, but you know, studios are afraid to take that risk. I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
But that's a great point. How do they become that if not taking that first chance?
Well, and I guess it's you got to see something in them. Obviously, Bradley in that movie was just, he just embodied a full-on, like, confident, strong, devil-may-care guy.
But if you ask Bradley, the funny part is he always says he was playing me in the movie. I don't see myself as that guy, but he just says I was playing Todd the whole time.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, and I always go, I wish I looked like that. My whole life would be different.
Well, okay, so this is a good transition to War Dogs, because I read this quote where you said, it's weird to be making a film that no one's waiting for.
Because mm-hmm.
really...
It's been a while since... I think it's been a while since I've made a movie that nobody's waiting for. Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't have a built-in, like, expectation and
right.
audience. And,
yeah.
So War Dogs is based on an article you read in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
It's about two young guys who, played by Jonah Hill and Miles Teller, who become sort of accidental arm dealers to the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is definitely a character movie. It's two characters. It's a two-hander about these two guys, pretty much, even though Miles is sort of our point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And then you
right.
see how the U.S. government manipulates NATO treaties by using the gray market to get around sanctions to
That's
be able
right.
to fund these wars
yeah.
with our allies or temporary allies.
Right.
And it's kind of crazy, but it couldn't be more different than your last slate of movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a comedy.
Right.
It's got an international feel. It's got a political scope to it. So I wonder if you just take me through your thought process the first time you read that article and how your mind started working as you were reading through it.
Yeah. Well, still, you say, you know, it's a big leap from the other movies, but still it's based on this relationship between these two guys.
Yes.
And these two quote-unquote fuck-ups in a way. And unlikely arms dealers, as you say, or accidental arms dealers. What appealed to me at first and what always attracts me is sort of a character. And then you go, wow, this world and this, you know, I haven't seen this that much, this world. And there's part of a weight that comes with that in just like, you know, if they were drug dealers in Miami, we all know what that is. You can get we spend 10 minutes of this movie just explaining what they even do so you understand
right.
what it is, because it is such an out there concept. But really what attracted me was the idea of guys who are anglers. I've always been also attracted to sort of anglers and guys that are looking for loopholes and this idea of kind of like we all know the system is rigged, you know, and how do we get in on that?
Which makes these guys, it makes you root for them even though they're bad guys.
Yeah. And are they bad guys though? I mean, really ultimately when you watch the movie, I think through the correct lens, you realize it's really an indictment on the government
yes.
more than it's indictment on these two clowns that just
yes,
sort
because
of stumbled into
if
this
if they
thing.
Can figure out, like, if this is, they're just doing what everyone else is doing.
And I think Bradley says a line in the movie, he says, look, the government wants to look the other way, don't give them a reason not to, and I think that's exactly what the movie's ultimately about, which is what you said, which is like, this gray area of like, they knew these guys couldn't source 100 million rounds after two Iraq wars and, you know, basically a drought in that kind of ammo without having to go to sort of nefarious sources that were not on the up and up with the government. So they kind of knew these guys were doing it in a roundabout way. But they chose to look the other way until they couldn't any longer.
Which is the only way they could get it done.
That's what I mean. Right, right. So that's what I mean by saying it's more of an indictment on sort of the U.S. procurement policy and the U.S. and the Pentagon in a way. But yeah, and it sounds more complicated than it is. There is fun in the movie.
No, absolutely. But when I say weird. It's not a comedy, yeah. What I mean is you could have taken this and you could have mined it for more comic moments, and it would have taken away from the aspects of drama, and like, it's a very thrilling, cerebral movie that I would think you would look at this and go, I have to not go to my first instinct of finding the joke in this scene.
Right.
So I guess when I asked what your experience was reading the article, have you ever adapted a true story before?
No, I've been down the road before, and you know, you'll read an interesting article, so I've gone down that road before, call up the writer, go meet with them, da da da. But you realize pretty quickly sometimes is like, you know, obviously not every article is worthy of a movie. And as you sort of start to unpack it, you go, there's not really enough there. With this one, as we sort of unpacked it, it just got more and more, and it just became like the movie just kind of laid out itself to me in a really clear way. But it's not easy because you're taking 5 pages of source and turning it into a film.
Right.
But again, since it really happened, there's research you do. You can read court transcripts. You can meet with people. You can, you know.
Right. And then tone-wise, it's, you know, you could have gone more comic with it. You could have made more of a comic meal out of some of the scenes that you instead played for a thrill or a suspense.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to relearn some things about writing and directing that you hadn't had to do on some of the comedies?
I'm not really, and I again, to me, you know, it's all storytelling. It's all beginning, middle, and end. It's all when do you reveal certain things about certain characters and pull them out. And also, you know, I certainly think like with the Hangover movies, even though they're flat-out comedies, for sure, we would fuck around with the tone of those movies, too, where The Hangover, even the first one, is a genuine mystery going on, too.
For sure,
and
yeah.
There are generally, like, messed-up moments that have nothing to do with being funny, and Hangover, and they got progressively darker to most people's chagrin, but to my delight. But no, they definitely got darker. So, again, I didn't see it as that big of a leap, but listen, all you are as a director ultimately is the purveyor of tone, as you kind of alluded to before. So this is definitely a trickier tone than what I've done before because of that balance with comedy and drama.
I think you said something like that in comedy you always have a crutch that you could do something over the top to get out of a scene.
Right. You can always cut to Zach slipping on a banana peel.
Right, right. But in this case, you didn't want to rely on that, or you couldn't.
Well, you couldn't, yeah.
And I think in this article you said that awakened you. Was there something more satisfying about pulling off this film? And I think of that scene between Miles Teller and Ana de Armas where she plays his wife and she's asking him to stop lying.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't stop lying.
Right.
Even when he thinks he's not lying anymore, he's still lying.
Yeah.
And it's such an insight into the male mind of control.
Yes.
And
control of information.
Control of information, thinking you can still get out of it.
Yes.
You know, and I thought that scene hits me on so many different levels of understanding. And you know, it's really one of those scenes where there's genuine regret, and it says a lot about intimacy and marriage. And I just wonder if when you write a scene like that and you pull that off, if that's a different kind of satisfaction to you than something chaotic or
And it's really funny that you bring up that scene, because that scene to me was the most daunting scene of the whole movie. And I probably didn't even articulate it in my head the way you just did. And that's probably why I was always going like, oh, we got that scene tomorrow, next week, that's a tough one, and da-da-da. Why is that tough? Well, because I've never done anything like that scene before,
yeah.
You're right. After that, I do remember being like, boy, I really think we got that. I think we really nailed that scene. She's phenomenal in it. Miles is great. So there was a satisfaction, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those scenes that you need to turn a story from a real life account of something that happened, you know, because it's interesting. I think there's documentary elements about this film too.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you use the same chapter ideas that you did in Frat House.
Yeah.
Where there's black title cards with quotes.
Yeah, it's funny you realize that.
Yeah, and I think to pull a human story out and use that to be able to I guess, give the audience empathy for the Miles Teller character in a way, but also to give them a life and stakes.
Right.
Was that something when you wrote it that, like, did you have a lot of versions of that scene?
I think we did. We had a lot of versions of this movie. This was a bear of a movie in every way. The writing of it, the shooting of it, the editing of it. This movie was, for some reason, just sometimes they're just bears, and this was one of them. And that scene was one we just kept going back to and tweaking and kept sort of finding the right level of anger and the right level of, as you say, him sort of trying to control the information or lying. And yeah, it was a tricky one. It was a tough movie all in.
What does it make you want to do next now that you've done a film like this?
I mean, it's not like I would never do comedy again. I love comedy.
Sure,
I could see my next movie being straight up comedy again. There's so many funny actors out there I'm dying to work with that I haven't worked with before. But I also really, as you know, from the beginning of my career, from the three documentaries I made before ever making a narrative film, I really do love reality, a reality-based story, something true. You know, I would love to make a great biopic, you know. And I also just love this idea from the very beginning of truth being stranger than fiction. It's always been sort of really appealing to me, so I wouldn't mind exploring this area a little bit more.
I mean, I think you're a filmmaker that can polarize critics a little bit and that I think can be misunderstood a little bit. Like, I think sometimes the chaos gets in the way of the relationships and the connection you have with your audience. I think people go to see your films. I mean, they know they're going to have a good time, but they also see something very true and they see themselves in the relationships.
Right.
And I wonder if you sort of feel like over your career that some of that gets overlooked a little bit.
My only issue I have with critics is when they say we make gross out comedies, because we never do anything. My worst thing in the world, anybody who knows me, is bathroom humor. Like, I literally, it's my Achilles heel. Like, if I see that kind of thing in a movie, it's just, like,
right.
And so I always hate just being dismissed as, like, a raunchy, gross
in that crowd of directors in that kind of movies.
Yeah, it's just never been my style, and it's never been something we do. So it always gets, like, I don't like it when it's very reductive when they're like, oh, it's a gross-out comedy, The Hangover. I'm like, it's a gross-out comedy? There's nothing gross in The Hangover.
Right.
It's ridiculous. It's absurd. It's over the top. The guys are in over their heads and da-da-da, but it's not gross-out comedy. I don't even know what that means. But as a filmmaker, you really, really, especially in this day and age, need to have thick skin. I think Martin Scorsese needs thick skin, let alone me, who gets killed all the time. I just think it's just part of the thing. I think critics in the last 10 years are competing with, you know, 15-year-olds on the internet who have a big Twitter following. So critics have become particularly more venomous.
They have to go to one extreme or the other.
That's right.
Yeah.
They I'm not making excuses, and I'm not saying, oh, they really like the movies. That's fine. Everybody has an opinion. But so what you do learn is you have to have thick skin, and you just have to avoid it, because it really, you don't want it to get in your head when you're making the next one.
Right.
Yeah.
It's always that thing. When someone makes something that gets you at a different level in terms of, like, for me, the way that the U.S. government and the way the basic exposition of the movie and the information is set, it's a different tone. And I don't know, I think it's going to make people see your films in a different way.
You know, it's so tricky in this summer and in this marketplace and just the way movies are going now. It's like, what are people really showing up to see? And this movie, you know, we talked about goodwill and have it being perishable. You know, the Hangover movies and Due Date combined made $1.6 or $7 billion for Warner Brothers. I had a lot of goodwill. I don't think you can get War Dogs made at any... I don't think I could have gotten War Dogs made at any other studio. It's just that I had so much goodwill built up at Warner's, and credit to them for saying, okay, go do your thing. Now you just hope people turn up and see it. You know, it's definitely...
Well, that's a
crazy... You know, because people say all the time, like, well, they don't make any original movies anymore. They're not making movies for adults. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
Like, the movie you just explained is that. But then when they don't show up, that's why they don't make it. So, you know, you really hope we can cut through the noise of releasing the movie in the summer, which made me nervous at first. You know, Warner's is like, well, it's you, and your movies are summer movies. I'm like, but this isn't such a summer movie. But they're like, this is going to be a good weekend. And they show you the other movies that have opened up on that weekend in the last 5 years. And you go, oh, that's cool. Oh, I didn't know. Oh, really? Inglourious Basterds? That was great. And that makes sense. And so you get into it, and then you realize, like, Jesus, how do you cut through the noise of the summer, you know?
Right.
It's amazing.
Well, there's such a crazy expectation. I think you're in a tough position to be the guy who a string of films earn that much money, and they, and it changes your own expectation, right? Because
I have a very realistic view of the business and what this movie is and where this movie sort of places in the pantheon of films. But I'm sure there's a review out there that's going to say, oh, this is no Hangover. I don't know. You know, it's like that wasn't the intention with the movie.
But. Right. But I would think that it'd be hard to, when so much success has come in that arena, to then have people who are letting you make a film and sort of in the back of their mind, they're thinking, oh, well, Todd Phillips is making it, it's going to make a bunch of money.
Mm.
And you can't have that kind of expectation on a piece of art.
It's right? pretty tough.
So I just want to close with something that you said about the experience of going to the movies. Because I think that going to the movies in a theater with a bunch of strangers is sort of the most common psychological experiment that we all place ourselves in on a regular basis. We go and we get emotional with strangers in a room, and not only that, but we get to see reflected emotion, so we get to see what collectively makes someone laugh, what collectively makes someone cry.
Right.
And we learn about ourselves, I think, from going to the movies. And you had this quote that I thought was great where you said, why are we in such a hurry to turn movies into television?
And, right.
But I wonder if that comes from an experience that you had as a kid or at some point in your life where you had an experience at a movie theater that really stuck with you and you saw it as special.
I've had a lot of special experiences at movie theaters, and I come from the school of the movie theater as church sort of thing. I wasn't brought up religious, but the movie theater was our church or temple or whatever. And I remember going to see Eddie Murphy's Raw. I was probably 12 years old or something, and seeing it in a theater full, and literally I remember this one woman, he said something and she ran up to the screen and touched the screen and ran back to her seat. And it's like, particularly as a comedy filmmaker, it's so additive seeing a film. When you see The Hangover with 400 people at the Universal City Walk, and you watch Hangover on HBO, even if it's your first time watching it, it's just not, I don't care what anybody says, it's not the same experience. There's an electricity to seeing a movie and everyone laughing at the same time. And that goes for horror movies and everyone jumping at the same time and everyone crying at the same moment in a great drama. You can't match that or replicate that at home. And you could replicate screen size and you could replicate resolution and you could replicate all that bullshit, but you can't replicate the crowd experience. And that's the only thing to me that separates us right now from every other thing that we're competing with, whether it's the internet, whether it's great television, of which there is so much of, whether it's Pokemon Go, I don't even know what that is, but I don't know why I said that, because that probably, I have no idea what that is. But the one thing we have as the one thing that separates movies from every other form is that shared experience. So I said that quote because it was in reaction to people talking about this technology of like all movies being available at home on Friday night and da da da. And I just think we're really short shrifting the experience. But I also understand that you sound like an old man and times are changing and this is probably where it's headed. But, you know, for my money, it just seems to me tragic because it's just such a part of the experience of watching a film.
No, I feel the same way, and it's one of the few things left that we get together and do as people. And I don't know where life is going when we don't do anything as a crowd.
As a group anymore, yeah.
You know?
Well, it's funny because one of the first things, if somebody says to me, oh, I saw your movie on Friday, and I go, my first question is always where? Like, it's always where? And they go, oh, well, the studio sent me a da-da-da, and I go, You know, because it's like, I just want people to see it in the room with other people. It's interesting.
As you go forward, do you still have fears about being able to make films with the budget you want to make? Or
I don't have fears about it. I mean, it's a concern. The business is shifting all the time, and I'm not somebody who would be good at or want to do, or I'm not even saying they want me to do a comic book movie. That's not my thing. So you do get like, oh, I hope I'll still be able to do this. But at the same time, no, I'm not that worried about it. I've had a good run. I have a great studio at Warner's that trust me and able to make a movie like this, and I feel like I'll be able to get movies made, but you never know.
Well, I think War Dogs is a fascinating film. I think everyone should see it in the theater. And
thank you.
And you know, I'm just, it's very nice to sit down and finally have this conversation with you.
You know, I love the show, so I'm excited.
Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that's our show. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with chronic overachiever Adam Scott.
I always thought I would feel content at some point, but I don't. I think I still have a really long way to go creatively and sort of career-wise. I haven't really done the big special thing that I've always dreamed of, even though I don't particularly know what that is.
You probably knew him as Ben Wyatt from Parks and Recreation. But he's been acting in independent films, big studio comedies, and network and independent TV for years. He also hosts a podcast and writes and produces numerous projects. So why is it he still feels like he doesn't do enough? We'll find out when I see you next time off camera.